Hello and welcome to the Innovation Forum podcast for Friday, 18th of October, with me, Ian Welsh. Coming up this week, we have a fascinating discussion that Megan Jones, Senior Vice President at Ipsos, and I had with a group of young consumers while we were at Innovation Forum's Sustainable Innovation Conference in Detroit last week. All year, we've been featuring the results of research Ipsos and Innovation Forum have partnered on into changing consumer attitudes across the generations. So it was great to hear from some actual young consumers what they and their peers think about business and sustainability issues and how they affect their purchasing decisions. And thinking ahead to Innovation Forum's flagship Sustainable Landscapes event in London next month, there's another chance to hear an interview my colleague Toby Webb recorded earlier this year with David Cleary, Director for Agriculture at the Nature Conservancy. All that to come, but first we have the usual roundup of some of what's been happening in business and sustainability. Unilever has said that it plans to cut by 50% the amount of virgin plastic that it uses over the next 5 years. Currently, the company uses 700,000 tonnes of new plastic every year. It will cut its use by using more recycled plastics and other material. The move is being made specifically to appeal to younger consumers, who consistently express concerns around plastic use. Unilever's pledge follows up on similar targets set by Procter & Gamble, which announced earlier this year that it would halve the amount of plastic it uses by 2030. Nestle and Coca-Cola are among other companies who have also made similar pledges in plastic use recently. However, these plans to use more recycled plastics may come up against some cost barriers, according to a new report from commodity market specialist S&P Global Platts, which says that the price of recycled plastic flakes used to make many new plastic products has become $72 a tonne more expensive than using virgin plastic. Historically, making products from recycled flakes has been cheaper. The report says that the trend is driven in part by the growing demand from the likes of Unilever for recycled plastic. Another factor is the growing availability of cheap petrochemicals from the US shale gas boom. The price rises may cost manufacturers an extra $250 million a year, the analysis says. Product innovation is clearly a big part of the plastics debate, and Carlsberg has revealed two new prototype bottles made effectively from paper, with a thin internal barrier that allows the bottle to hold liquids. The barrier is made from either recycled PET or a bio-based alternative. Development of the bottles is part of Carlsberg's Together Towards Zero initiative, which includes commitments to reach zero carbon emissions by 2030. And to help fund some of its sustainability initiatives, including reducing plastic content in packaging, tackling water use and engaging with suppliers, PepsiCo has announced a new $1 billion green bond. PepsiCo has pledged to cut use of virgin plastic, very much on trend this week, by 35% by 2025, removing 2.5 million tonnes in total. The Roundtable for Responsible Palm Oil is reported to be preparing to start imposing fines on consumer goods companies that don't buy more certified sustainable palm oil. In 2018, 13.5 million tonnes of certified palm oil was produced, but only half was sold at the premium price that reflects the greater cost of production. Growers have blamed consumer goods companies for not being prepared to pay the slight premium. According to draft regulations, the RSPO will make it mandatory for palm oil buyers among its membership to increase the proportion of sustainable palm oil in its purchases by 15% per year, or face fines or possible suspension from the round table. All the big players, Unilever, Nestle, Procter & Gamble, PepsiCo and so on, are members of the RSPO. Looks like there will be plenty to discuss at the RSPO Annual General Meeting next month. Later this month, the next Innovation Forum's Future for Plastics event series will be in Amsterdam on the 30th and 31st of October, and it's gearing up to be the biggest yet, and we'll be joined by senior representatives from Reckitt, Benckiser, Nestle, Walgreens Boots Alliance, Unilever, Coca-Cola, Plastics Europe and many more, and there's still a few places available. And then on the 20th and 21st of November in London, we'll be hosting our biggest event of the year, the Sustainable Landscapes and Commodities Forum. Among those already confirmed to join the 350-plus delegates are the key people from Mondelez, Nestle, Golden Agri Resources, IKEA, Greenpeace, World Bank, Consumer Goods Forum and the World Resources Institute. This one is not to be missed, and you can save £100 on conference passes if you register to attend before close on Friday 18th this week. Over the past few months, we've been featuring at Innovation Forum conferences results from some partnered research with Ipsos. We did this again last week at the Impact and Innovation event in Detroit, but this time we assembled a panel of 20-something consumers to critique the research and give their impressions on how their peers engage or not with businesses and social and environmental impacts. So, here joining Ipsos's Megan Jones and me are Meyer Bendikar, Connor Larkin and Anya Shapiro from the University of Michigan, and Caitlin Brooke-Harris from Columbia University.
Megan, why don't you take us through some of the key points from your most recent analysis of the data that you've collected?
Sure, thanks very much, Ian. It's great to be back at Innovation Forum in Detroit. So Ipsos was talking with Innovation Forum following last year's conferences, and we're starting to talk about how the consumer's missing a little bit from the sustainability story. So we started to dig into, you know, what do we know about consumer and sustainability, and some rapid fire data here. We know that consumers don't trust business, especially in the United States. We know that consumers want to put doing good before making profit. We know that consumers believe that behaviors need to change to avert environmental disaster. We know that they're favorable and want to pay for sustainable products. We see that brands are being rewarded for their sustainability actions, particularly by young consumers, and that brands are being punished where they don't share consumer values. But we also know that there's this gap between aspiration and action when it comes to consumer engagement in sustainability. So our research was around how consumers make decisions. How can we think about that gap, and what can we think about doing to engage consumers to try to bridge that gap? And so I'll just talk more here about the young people data, which we know is what's so interesting. So we know environmental issues are salient globally. In the United States, governance is much more of a focus, the fair treatment of workers, compliance with regulation. But young people in the United States are much, much more likely to say that environment is a key issue for them, particularly the under 25s. When it comes to where people get information about sustainability, I mean, we know that knowledge is a key barrier for people. People rely very much on product labeling in the United States. They also rely a lot on internet search, and they really trust independent groups and labels and scientists and academic researchers. But what was really interesting in our data here was that young people are much more likely to trust scientists and academic researchers than they are any other type of information source, including independent groups and labels. They're also much more likely to be trusting of information in general, and I think that's really interesting. We have a significant point difference between young people who trust in information and older people who trust in information. And then finally, I think we're starting to see that young consumers are feeling some more responsibility towards sustainability. They seem to blame business a little less than older consumers do for the sustainability challenges that we're facing. And they seem to feel that the consumer has more of a role in resolving the sustainability crises. So some really interesting data there on consumer perceptions in general, but obviously also the young consumer and how different the young consumer seems to be to older groups.
You've done some fascinating slides to go alongside this. You presented them earlier on today, and we'll share those alongside this podcast. Yep. What we thought we'd do today is test some of these theories, always dangerous perhaps, test some of these theories with a panel of younger consumers. And I'm delighted I'm also joined by Meyer Bendikar, Connor Larkin and Anya Shapiro, all from the University of Michigan, and also Caitlin Brooke-Harris from Columbia University. So welcome, panel. What I'd like to do is put some questions to you relating to that research and also to your wider perception. So how do you find out about the sustainability of products? Anya, why don't you start us?
So I think part of the importance of sustainability is transparency. A lot of consumers in the millennial cohort do look at labels. Me personally speaking, I'm more distrustful of labels and would more likely be willing to look at sort of an independent third-party source that, for example, would rank companies in terms of their carbon footprint or in terms of their waste management potential. Everyone has their own strategy of dealing with this, but I personally, it's important to make sure that I have a third party that's as unbiased as possible ranking these systems so that I can inform my buying decisions.
So some sort of, you say, a trusted third party certification perhaps, or an NGO that you would trust would be the way you would go for your information. Maya, how does that reflect your own personal choices around purchasing and how you find out about sustainability of products?
Yeah, so I think having a third party evaluate the sustainability of particular products is a great idea. I think we need to have more of that happen in just like when we are looking at everyday products. I know at a panel earlier, there was a gentleman that mentioned like in creating an app to maybe measure the sustainability implications of maybe the life cycle of each of the different products that you're about to purchase. And I think that's a great idea, especially with the rise of big data coming up, like you were mentioning before, Anya. I think that for me personally, it's more of a brand story. And I think a lot of young consumers can resonate with that, that I'm more attached to a brand than I am a product. So having a positive brand perception for me in terms of sustainability is really important in terms of the products that I buy.
Let's come back to talking about brands a bit later on. Connor, for you, what sorts of information do you trust and why?
So I think to answer that question, I'll also to expand a little bit on I think some of the great points that were made earlier about trust around brands. It's the amount of information that we see today is enormous, and it's incredibly hard to understand what is trustworthy, what is more credible than other sources of information. And I do think one trend that is becoming significant in terms of how I or young consumers trust information or trust corporations about what they're doing is the degree to which they have a positive campaign, whether they're telling stories about their impact. Perhaps in the past, companies thought they might be able to take actions, but not necessarily publicize such actions. Something we were talking about earlier today is that if you're not telling your story, then someone else is going to tell it for you at some point. And that's probably not going to be done in the manner in which you would hope it was done. So I think as a consumer, I'm looking for brands to be telling stories about what they're doing. I would hopefully be critical about such story that they're telling. But if they're not in the public eye attempting to write that narrative, then I'm going to assume there's no positive narrative to be written at all.
Interesting point. Okay. Caitlin, same sort of question. What sorts of information do you trust?
So the very first way I found out about sustainability was really through labels, especially the sustainable seafood labels, which also goes back to Anya's point about third-party certifications. So through these certifications, they do have certain labels that you can find on products such as like Fair Trade or the Forestry Sustainable Corporation. So me seeing those labels really resonates with me and reminds me, oh, I'm doing a great deed for our environment by purchasing this product because it has this distinctive label attached to it that says this was made by someone that has a living wage or this was made with the intent to reduce carbon dioxide. But outside of labels, it kind of opens a field to find out more about sustainability through social media and internet searches, which goes back to your research about everything.
Sure. Do you trust your friends when you come to product choice?
A little bit. I take what they have to say, but then I'll do my own internal research as well. So it's a bit of talking to friends and family, but backing up and validating what they're saying.
Sure. Anya, I'm going to put the reverse question to you. What don't you trust?
If a company puts out a sustainability statement with no empirical data behind it, I think as a consumer, it's quite easy to figure that out. So to the extent possible, if there is sort of empirical evidence that they can provide to back up their claims, that would certainly help. But I think a lot of consumers in the millennial cohort sort of are suspicious and almost discount unilateral claims like we are a green company, right? It has to have some teeth behind it.
For companies to say these things, you want to get what basis do they have for saying that? Yeah. Next question, really coming back to something that Anna, you brought up in our session just now. So if you guys feel that you are part of the post-privacy generation, how does that make you feel? And how does that affect the way that you engage with consumer choices? Anna, you made the point, so you kick off.
So I will say that I am sort of a futurist when it comes to this question. I think right now we live at a time where ideas about privacy are still a little bit mixed, and it is important to make sure that we're taking measures to protect privacy wherever possible. However, you know, in the next 100, 200 years, I do think we will start to live in a post-privacy generation. And within that, I'm sort of optimistic about it because I think that when companies do have our preferences, our values at their disposal, it'll be really hard for them to deny that sustainability is something they should be worried about. So right now it's, you know, there's all these questions which Megan's research gets into about, well, how much do consumers really care about sustainability? But I'm confident that if our data is public to these companies, that case will start to become increasingly clear.
Meyer, same question to you then. How do you feel about your privacy and how does that affect when you're engaging with brands and products? How does that affect the way you do so?
a lot of the big corporations, I'm obviously more skeptical towards in terms of buying their products. And I think that a lot of people are too, just because these are the companies that just already know who I am before coming into the grocery store. And whether that's a good or a bad thing is up to the consumer, obviously. But I think that, to echo on his point, as we become more transparent to the company and as they begin to understand more of consumer attitudes towards sustainability, they will hopefully be able to use that as a positive influence to improving their own sustainability agendas within their corporations.
Connor, what's your relationship with big data like?
Oh, many feelings about my relationship with big data. But to perhaps to play devil's advocate a little bit to what's been said on the panel so far, I think that we absolutely live in a society where we can expect less privacy than we've had in the past. But that doesn't necessarily mean that consumers, young consumers like us, are going to be passively accepting that going into the future. And I do think, based on looking at the tech sector over the last few years, there are absolutely opportunities for brands to be positioning themselves as defenders of privacy. I mean, particularly in the wake of the 2016 election, companies like Facebook and Google, which do traffic in data, have suffered to some degree based on consumer perceptions around how they make money with that data. Whereas other companies, other large tech companies in the Valley, like Apple and Microsoft, have really, particularly Apple, I think, have been really actively seeking to position themselves as proponents of privacy. And I think there are opportunities there for brands.
Fine. Final question. I'll put this to you, Caitlin, and I'll bring everyone else in as well. Trust in brands, something that's come out a lot in our discussions just now and came out in our session earlier on. Caitlin, do you trust brands? But more importantly, what erodes that trust for you?
That's a good question. I'd say it's like a 50-50% trust in brands in general, because they do stand to open their transparency a lot more and sort of going towards what Myers said about consumers transparent to the companies. But I also feel like it should be reciprocated. Companies should be just as transparent with us. So if I've seen a history of transparency within a company, and even with their shortcomings, they come out and say, oh, we really didn't hit this goal, but we're still trying, they have earned my complete trust. And then a company on the other side that has a history of greenwashing and continually tries to say, oh, we're really being really sustainable, but you look at their history, you look at the news reports and what other people are saying, and that's not true, then that trust is kind of lacking and they have to work really hard to kind of get away from that reputation. So it really depends.
Sure. Okay. Well, it's all very complicated, isn't it?
Yeah.
Maya, same question to you then. What erodes your trust?
Yeah, so I guess what erodes trust in brands is, so I'm largely influenced by my social media network. So I would say that the things that I see on social media are likely to erode my trust in a brand. How news spreads to millennials is often through social media, right? So I think we see, for example, I believe it was like the Fairlife Milk Dairy Farm, and their video came out about them. There's animal abuse like caught on camera, and like they also had a partnership with Coke, and everyone was spreading that video around, and my immediately like my like trust in that brand that I've been drinking like my whole life just gone. Like I hopefully have not touched Coca-Cola since then, since they were partners with them. And I think like how to improve that negative brand perception would be to, again, be more transparent from the inside as well. So I think internally, I think if you can actually show that your company has a culture of being sustainable, I think that's super important. And if you can somehow display that externally, which is hard, I think that you'll gain a lot of people's trust back and you will be able to become a more sustainable company in the future.
Thank you. It may surprise you to learn that Gen Xers get a lot of information from social media as well. Connor, same question to you. What erodes your trust in a brand?
I think very similar things to what we've heard on the panel so far. And maybe to boil that down to one thing, at least for me, is integrity. As we're sort of embarking on this path of sustainability, both as consumers and for corporations, it's difficult and it's challenging. And I don't think that consumers should necessarily expect all brands to be capable of making this transition seamlessly or instantaneously, but companies shouldn't be making claims about things that they're not doing, things that they're doing if they're not actually doing them in fact. And I think DeMeyer's point is that in today's world, it is kind of a post-privacy world. It seems likely that if a company is doing something that it shouldn't be, it's going to come out at some point, and it's going to be a video, it's going to be viral somehow. And if the company doesn't get ahead of that, then the fallout is going to be far worse than if they had just said at the outset that we are making strides, but we're not perfect. And we are going to be as transparent as possible about the good things we're doing and the areas that we need to improve on. So that's what I like.
Anya, that point to you, isn't that the key then, that kind of you want brands to be transparent and honest? Say, look, hey, we're not perfect. And is that the sort of thing that gives you trust in a brand?
A lot of what's been said has been absolutely brilliant and on point. I think a public apology goes a long way, first of all. Second of all, I think that a lot of the times sustainability is seen as like an ad hoc addition to the company's strategy. And what would erode my trust is if a company says that it's a sustainable business, and then you realize that, you know, the CEO has never once acknowledged sustainability in his or her public comments. Sustainability tends to be something that mid-level employees talk about a lot more than CEOs. And we're starting to see that change now with initiatives like the CEO Climate Dialogue coming out in support of carbon pricing. But to the extent that CEOs can be more involved in the sustainable business movement, I think that would help build consumer trust.
Well, thank you very much. Megan, coming back to you, what is what you've heard this morning? How does it reflect what you were expecting given the research you've been doing?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's some feeling of vindication in the comments that we've heard, that I think align pretty well with what the data was saying. And Caitlin, I think on the panel earlier, said that she felt some vindication in that the data was reflecting her view. So, I mean, I definitely think that the researchers told us a story here, which makes sense. Young people want to hold business to account, and transparency is really key in building trust in a brand, and data is really important in the process of being transparent and then being honest about mistakes, which I found really interesting. For me, I think the thing that we didn't necessarily get that I needed more explanation for was being more trusting of information. And that was a really interesting data point for me. But I think what I've gathered from this conversation, from all of you, is the confidence that you have in your ability to understand the information, and your ability to tease out what's true, to tease out what's credible, to know where there's evidence, to know what seems suspicious. And to me, that relationship with information, that was a really cool finding from the conversation today.
Great. Well, thank you very much. And listeners, we're going to continue our association with Ipsos over the coming year. And if you want to get involved in the research, you want to get involved in what sort of questions we're going to be asking, then do get in touch with us. But for now, my thanks to Megan Jones from Ipsos, and also to Maya Bendekar, to Connor Larkin, Caitlin Brooke-Harris and Anya Shapiro for their time today as well. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
As a preview to some of the issues we'll be talking about in London at the Sustainable Landscapes Conference next month, here's another chance to listen to Innovation Forum's Toby Webb talking with David Cleary, Director for Agriculture at the Nature Conservancy, from earlier this year.
Now, we're both here at the end of our Future of Food conference in Chicago, where you took part in a panel about landscapes and deforestation, and we had a really interesting chat about Latin America. So we thought we'd do a quick podcast on the deforestation and land conversion hotspots in Latin America as you see them. You've lived down there, kind of live and breathe Latin America and the Cerrado and so on. Apart from the Cerrado, where are the other places where some of these problems are occurring? And let's also talk about Cerrado solutions as well.
Sure. We've just had some statistics in the last couple of months. There's been an uptick of deforestation in the Brazilian Amazon, also an uptick in deforestation in the Hispanic Amazon. The Brazilian Amazon, that's as usual linked more to beef than anything else. Hispanic Amazon, there's some deforestation linked to expansion of palm oil. Beyond the Amazon, we've actually got something of a deep freeze on conversion in the Brazilian Cerrado, very little of it in the last couple of years. That's mainly because of market conditions, fairly low prices for soy, and more recently a collapse in the Chinese demand because of African swine flu out there. We are, however, seeing some expansion of conversion in the Bolivian lowlands, eastern Bolivia. That is actually linked to soy. That's a fairly active agricultural frontier right now. And you're continuing to see a certain amount of land conversion in the Paraguayan Chaco. That's linked to beef, not soy.
And this link between swine flu and soy demand,
yeah.
Just what is that?
Soy is one of the main ingredients for animal feed, including pig feed. So if you have something like a 30 to 40% collapse in size of your pig herd, which is what's happening in China, I mean, think Black
Death. They've lost 30 or 40% of their
pork. They're on the way to do that. You know, think Black Death for pigs. That's basically...
So the Chinese is one of the few countries that has a strategic pork reserve.
Yes, so they're going to need it.
They're going to need it. Okay, wow. So in the Cerrado, it's only about price then that stopped deforestation. What about the Cerrado Manifesto and all the hand-wringing and campaigns? That must have made some difference, surely.
I think it has made some difference. I mean, it certainly made a difference in the visibility of the Cerrado, but as always, those sorts of things take time to feed through to driving change on the ground. I mean, we don't have an agreement in place in the Cerrado yet. I mean, I hope there will be one. There's a lot of discussions about it. We may well have one before the end of this year, but it's too early yet for those kind of supply chain discussions and supply chain agreements to feed into changing things actually on the ground.
And how about places like the Chaco? The Chaco's kind of been added on to the Cerrado in a list of people's concerns.
Yep.
You don't hear as much about it, but it's sort of on the menu now, so to speak, as a concern.
Yep.
But what's happening there, and are there any significant efforts to prevent deforestation and land conversion down there?
Right now, there's not much concretely happening. I think there's a lot of preparatory work being done, a lot of analysis being done. The Nature Conservancy and some other NGOs, Fundación Vida Silvestre in Argentina, WWF in Paraguay, they've been doing a lot of work on helping to set up monitoring systems and thinking about what the future might hold. We're not seeing any dramatic acceleration in deforestation and land conversion in those geographies yet. I think the worry is not so much right now, but you know, soy in particular, if the Chinese situation gets sorted out and demand for soy rises, you're pretty much tapped out in the rest of Argentina and Paraguay for soy production. The fear is that the future vectors of soy production will be in the Chaco. And there's a certain linkage, I think, to an extent between the Cerrado and the Chaco. So if the Cerrado gets sorted out, then the Chaco may be like next in the pipeline as, oh, well, it's a bit of a problem to be doing stuff in the Cerrado, so let's focus more on the Chaco. So
can I ask you about beef?
Yeah.
At these conferences, often people legitimately say, where's the beef?
Yeah.
In the sense that we don't have the representation here. We talk a lot about palm, and palm has now fallen down the list. Yet we find it very hard to have sessions on beef and to engage beef companies. Why do you think that is? Is that because so many of them are having the highest impact are Brazilian and therefore just able to sort of hide away in Brazil?
Well, I think maybe that's some of it. I don't think they're hiding away. I mean, JBS, Marfrig, they have very active policies around deforestation. They don't get much play outside Brazil, but they're there. And also, I think some of the beef companies play an important role in trying to do positive things. I mean, I give McDonald's a shout out for a start. The difficulty is that the beef market is so much more fragmented. You have so many more market actors. It's pretty different from soy and palm oil, where you have like half a dozen big companies that dominate the whole trading side. The other thing that I think is a bit of a problem for you from the beef standpoint is that many of the ranchers who drive a lot of the deforestation, they're very small outfits and operations. They're not organized in producer associations. They don't have spokespeople. So from your standpoint, as somebody who's, you know, organizing conferences that would like to sort of drill into this, you have the problem of trying to identify who speaks for the sector in a way that you just don't have for the soy and the palm oil sectors.
Yes, I mean, you have the Global Roundtable on Sustainable Beef, but that seems to have quite a limited number of actors
in it.
Interesting. So coming back to soy for now, we are currently putting together our November 20th, 21st Sustainable Landscapes and Commodities Conference. And you had indicated to me that there might be something interesting happening by then. What are your hopes for action happening by November this year? What could that look like?
My hopes are that we have now for more than a year had a process underway that's within the framework of the Brazilian Soy Working Group. It's pulled in the group of mainly European companies that signed the statement of support for the Cerrado. And they have set themselves a sort of internal deadline of later this year to come up with an agreement. And I think if there is an agreement, that would be a really massive step forwards. And I think by November, it should be clear whether that agreement is going to happen or not. I should say that even if it doesn't happen, the issue is not going to go away. So either we will have an agreement by November through the Sahada Working Group, or we'll have some pretty interesting conversations about what other types of steps might be necessary to get to an agreement, because we have to get to an agreement in some shape or form.
A final question about Brazilian politics. There's been an awful lot said and written about Bolsonaro, the tropical Trump, and his policies, but it's harder than you might imagine to undermine the work that's been done so far, as I understand it. So is the politics of Brazil currently less of a risk than people might think?
Well, you know, I think there's obviously a ready audience for horror stories about what Bolsonaro has said or is going to do. He's very similar to Trump in that he doesn't really have the internal censor that previous generations of politicians have. He's very adept on YouTube and Twitter. He says horrendous things. Brazil has strong institutions, and in particular has a very strong court system. Anything that he tries to do along the lines that he's been talking about is going to end up in court, and there's no shortage of competent organizations in Brazil that will be on top of that kind of thing. Much more worrying is actually the stuff that he can do fairly easily as head of the government. So he could, for example, cut the budget of enforcement agencies within the Environment Ministry.
Obama, for example.
That's the kind of thing that I think we can expect. But the reality also is that, especially with the way that remote sensing technologies are going and the quality and strength of Brazilian NGOs, is that a lot of that slack can be taken up by Brazilian civil society. And also, there are legal obligations on the government implementing its own laws. So I expect that you'll see a lot of the lawyers in Brazil are going to be very busy over the next few years.
In general, are you more optimistic on deforestation, land use change, preventing it across Latin America than you were? I mean, TFA, the Tropical Forest Alliance, was recently in Colombia.
Yeah.
I saw some announcements afterwards. I know some people that were there.
Yeah.
They were pretty upbeat. The Colombian government has come out with some announcements since then. That sounds positive.
Yeah.
I mean, what's your overall picture?
Latin America is a big place, and there's lots of different countries there, and they move at different speeds. I mean, I think in general, there's been some very positive recent developments in Peru and in Ecuador and in Colombia. I think obviously you've got reason for concern in Brazil, but you've also got a few market issues that are working in your favor on the deforestation front, and in particular, the depressed Chinese demand for soy. I wouldn't be in this business if I wasn't to an extent a professional optimist. There are certainly headwinds. You know, we're never complacent, but there's stuff that's working in our favor as well, and we have to just sort of leverage off those.
Great. David, thanks so much for your time today.
Great. Pleasure, as always.
And listeners, if you want to know more about this, come and meet David and other experts at our Sustainable Landscapes and Commodities Forum in London on the 20th and 21st of November. Hope you can see us there. If you want to know more about deforestation issues in Latin America or elsewhere, have a look on our website. There's plenty of material there. And thank you for listening.
Don't forget, you can save £100 if you register this week to join the likes of David Cleary and hundreds of other experts at this year's Sustainable Landscapes Conference on 20th and 21st November in London. But that's all for now. I've been Ian Welsh, and I'll be back next week.